Now it's time for Power of Prophecy, continuing the legacy of Tex Mars, exposing evil, and promoting Jesus Christ as Savior. Here's your host, Jerry Barrett.
Hello, friends, and welcome to another edition of Power of Prophecy. I'm your host, Jerry Barrett, honored to have you join me again this week. I have asked my dear friend John Euler to come back on the show. I recently, with my wife, we went and saw the movie Sound of Freedom. And having done a decent amount of research on this topic, I knew a lot of what was going on, but it still has weighed heavy on my heart. And that is the reason that I contacted John so we could have a discussion about minor attracted persons. John, welcome back to Power of Prophecy.
Jerry, thank you for having me. It's a privilege.
It is my honor to, I love to talk to smart people, John, and
I like that.
You know, it puts me at least in the right neighborhood. You know, we have enough idiots out there that are on the major airwaves that we need real people talking about real issues. And And I love to talk to folks like yourself. Now, the title of this program is Minor Attracted Persons Normalizing Pedophilia. And this pedophilia has been going on for forever, hasn't it, John?
Mm-hmm. Ever since the fall.
That's the disturbing part. Because how can you discern if your neighbor or a family member is a pedophile? They look normal.
Yeah, that's the tricky thing, and that's why I encourage everyone, every Christian, every church leader, to get educated. And that is really the reason why I put together my training site, which is churchprotect.org. So I recommend Christians and church leaders go to that site if they want to start to get a handle on, get a sense of how do predators prey? How do they, and I'm not talking P-R-A-Y, right? How do they prey upon the most vulnerable? Because I did not know it. Back in my early career, I was heading into vocational ministry. I went to Talbot School of Theology. I took my 2 years of Greek, and I was heading in toward a MDiv. But the Lord changed that. I'm more geared to counseling. So I'm either a theologian that has really good counseling skills or a counselor that's got really good theology. I guess I'm the latter, which is crucial, right? Because we need to be able to help people as they negotiate the challenges on the path of life. But I was not aware, even though I had spent time a number of years as a youth director, in multiple different churches, I was not aware of anything to do with pedophiles. Fortunately, that was not my own lived experience, as they say. So I couldn't have conceived, and that's really where I start when trying to help people understand the minds, the motives and methods of pedophiles. And again, my clinical background, 30 years worth, kind of spans three primary populations. I've worked in all different kinds of settings. The first is working with survivors of sexual abuse. A number of those have been trafficked. So it's exactly kind of what we're talking about. So along with talking about minor attracted persons, maybe what we can do, Jerry, before the end of the program, we'll talk about how do churches help. Right. If someone has become viscerally engaged in the whole subject now, if their eyes have been opened, we really have two things we need to consider. One is the preventative. How do we stop the cockroaches? But then what do you do about people who have experienced that? And I'm convinced that about 40% of every church congregation, conservatively, it's 20%, but I think it's because, you know, if you ask someone if they've ever been abused, they will typically underreport because it's a very difficult thing to talk about. Same thing about perpetrators, by the way. right? So there can be two populations that will underreport what's gone on in their life. So with survivors, what churches need to know and what church leaders and Christians need to know is that within the average congregation, you have people that have experienced sexual perpetration, whether trafficking or not, but you have people, the majority of whom will be women, but there's a number of men that have experienced it as kids that will never disclose unless a church leader, unless the pastoral staff can create what's called the milieu, can create within their church a safe environment. Part of that comes down to theology. Because the majority of churches, you know, as goes the pastoral staff, so goes the church. And what I discovered, and unfortunately is very true, but in working with the perps, is that churches will end up having misplaced sympathies. And they will assume that perpetrators are the same thing as a prodigal. And so they will welcome guys. I'm not saying you ostracize. I have a plan, and I'll share this with you in brief, what I recommend to pastors. But I cannot tell you how many men that were involved in ministry were in my sex offender treatment groups in prison. Yet they were going to be welcomed with prodigal, you know, as though the prodigal was coming home when they got out of prison. Elder so-and-so, deacon so-and-so, you know, sometimes the pastor, youth pastors. And so churches and church leaders need to understand the nature of predators. It's very different than being a prodigal. These are two different categories. David was caught in a fall, but he was not a predator. That's why he was eligible for forgiveness. Once a man's mind is given over in Romans chapter 1, you don't read in Romans chapter 1. First of all, we don't read about child predation, so it shows you it's even worse than in Romans chapter 1. You know, I would have trusted Judas with a child. Let that sink in. Right? There's only one person in human history that we know that was ever Satan possessed, and that's Judas. I would not have trusted him with my credit card, but I would have trusted him with a child. So no wonder Jesus talked about a very large stone and a very deep body of water. Mm-hmm. And it's not talking about theology. You know, if anyone, you know, some of the pastors that I love, that I follow, will spiritualize that verse. Saying, well, if you offend one of these little ones, so a new believer theologically, well, okay, we can make that case. But I think if any passage can be taken at face value, we should do that. Because Jesus was speaking in clear Aramaic. You know, he was speaking to the audience. So in the context, he's talking about sort of a big tent theory. You know, the disciples were going to get exclusive, and Jesus said, no, let them come in. But then he knew, because these guys are so, the predators, because they are so good at impression management, that they're going to be in the church. Because their number one hunting ground of preference is not the trans movement. I speak about that all the time. I'm very concerned because of the dumbing down of those adults that now have been swooned into that whole movement. They have made it very easy for predators. And we get up in arms. We should get up in arms. All these guys that are hypersexualized, that are clearly accessing pornography, that are gyrating, you know, coming in dressed in drag, and we should get agitated. But at least we can spot those guys.
Right.
Right. We don't have a question. Leah Thomas, the deviant swimmer from Penn State, once I help someone see that he doesn't care about swimming, he's gaining access with a cell phone camera into the locker room of women. Once somebody can make that shift, then their eyes are open. Well, you can spot a guy in a one-piece Speedo on a girl's, you know, on a girl's swim team. We can spot all of those guys. But the one place it's most difficult to spot, and it's to your question, is the church makes the number one most favorite hunting ground of a pedophile for two reasons. All they need to succeed is to be given the benefit of the doubt. And where's the one place that people would be given the benefit of the doubt?
Yeah, in the church.
Right? And then we have been deluded by what I consider poor theology, that, you know, if you ask the majority of Christians, they will think the description of personality, you know, one of the character traits of the fruits of the Spirit is to be nice. Well, it doesn't mean we're to be jerks, but you won't find the word nice in there. Nice presupposes the person that you are interacting with considers you nice. But if you're establishing boundaries, if you're at the gate, at the sheep gate, right, if you're discerning and scrutinizing who's coming in and out, both theologically as well as actual people, you're not going to be nice. Because it's only a matter of time till you start to see some of the red flags. And then at that point, you're going to have to make a decision. So there are predators that have yet to be caught. Very few are ever caught. Then very few, about 1 in 1,000, are actually prosecuted. So that shows you the size of this problem. But since here's my contention, the most sophisticated of predators specifically target churches of all denominations. They don't care. They've learned the language of these different denominations. Now, some are more specific to that denomination, but some can turn it on, turn it off. Right? Some can sound like Southern Baptists one day, and then Presbyterians the next day, and then Charismatics the next day. They know how to do that. I mean, look at the word faith stuff. They can turn it on, turn it off. Now, if I lost my audience, you know, basically this. You know, God did not call us to material wealth. He called us to be wealthy in terms of spiritual fruit. And if what motivates me is blessings, otherwise being interpreted as material stuff, then how can I separate that theology from what Satan offered to Jesus in the desert? All these things are given to me. I can give them to whoever we want. So there's a theology that shifts focus to material things, and that's why we have the book of Job, that our theology shouldn't change, whether we have, like Paul said. So all that to say, I digress for a moment, but it's very important, because if my focus within the church is not on helping people discern and helping to spur one another on to love and good works, I'm going to miss likely the red flags of predators in my midst. So we need to be able to focus on the predators, and we'll talk about some of the warning signs. But then I really want to encourage churchgoers, pastors, to think in terms of, and I think this is equally important, if not more important, what do we do about those people that are suffering in silence, that were on the receiving end of this kind of stuff? Sound of Freedom talks about child trafficking. But for every one child that is trafficked, there are many more that are the victims of incest in churches, or being perped on or have been perped on by somebody connected to the church. Brother so-and-so, elder so-and-so, deacon so-and-so, pastor so-and-so. So as energized and exercised as we should become by watching this film, and I don't want to detract from it because I'm very thankful it's out, but I want people to understand that for every child that's trafficked, because that's risky business. There are many kids that are being perped on right in their own homes in one way or another by a family member. The vast majority of sexual abuse takes place by somebody that has regular access to a kid. And oftentimes those people are connected to churches in one way or the other. And so there's a code of silence. So we need to very much, again, be aware of not just the signs of predators, but the signs of predation. What is it? What are the signs that a child is being harmed? So that's another thing we can look at. But then the question is, how do you help? Because the majority of kids that are perped on will never disclose until later on when they become adults. And so we have, I'm convinced, in every congregation, you have probably upwards to 40% of people in your congregation that were impacted by having their sexual boundaries crossed. That's a given. And so SurvivorSupport.net was born out of my concern, because as I was doing trainings for churches, how to identify predators, that still exists. But I became very concerned that once the training was over, people sort of folded up their material and they thanked me and went on their way. And I thought, okay, we've missed something, because each church, I believe, should have in place, and hopefully this film now will begin to be that impetus to help churches begin to think in terms of both predator, you know, protecting against predators, being able to identify them, but then equally as important, if not more so, how do you begin to identify survivors and ultimately help them heal? Because churches will be the number one place that hurting people go to, as they should. But very few churchgoers, very few people on pastoral staff have been trained in, for instance, or are aware of what's called trauma therapy. So they don't know that there are stages the survivor will go through. They don't know that if they have, let's say, one of these kids that were trafficked, let's say a young person, again, I want people to think in terms of both trafficking, but what happens if there's a kid that's been going through incest? There's a number of cases. I have one on the website, SurvivorSupport.net, a very famous Christian family, and they were touring. They were a music family. It turns out dad was perping on all the girls for years. And so the question is, for, let's say a 25-year-old, let's say a 30-year-old. I have a couple of clients I'm working with right now that were perped on for years, and they had suppressed that. That's very a real thing. The idea of false memory syndrome is a fraud and stupid. It's very real to suppress things that are too hard to process. And we think we, you know, most people that haven't gone through trauma things, well, if something like that happens as kids, surely they're going to remember. No, not always. And I'll describe how very quickly. As an adult, think about the difference between a child's brain and an adult brain. Think about the size. You know, when you bring a newborn home from the hospital, think about that little beanie they always put on the child. Most parents keep that as a keepsake. And the question is this: could you put that beanie on your head now? Oh, you can put it on a little orange.
Right.
Think about just the size of our cranium compared to a newborn. Well, there's a whole lot of growing that's going to be done, height, weight, right? That's trajectory. Well, just as the body grows, our physical organ of the brain grows. And most people are familiar these days with child development, and not just physical development, but the brain as it's literally growing and developing and therefore expanding. A child is going through various stages, and most people know this intuitively, such as there's a point when you bring an infant home that the infant doesn't have a lot of imagination. We lay the infant down, we put the little mobile above it, and we try to help him see color, you know, cause and effect, and oh, look, you know, or the first time a parent shows a child his or her reflection in the mirror. Most parents remember that. But you bring a child home and you put a little stuffed animal in the crib or the bassinet, and the child won't really engage with that stuffed animal. But you give enough time goes by, days, weeks, months, and years, before you know it, that little stuffed animal is that child's best friend. The child is named the stuffed animal. The child interacts with that stuffed animal, and you better not try to take that stuffed animal away from that child when it gets ratty and okay, the question is, what happened? How does it go from no interaction to that stuffed animal now is his or her best friend to eventually the child may choose on his or her own to put that little stuffed animal away in a keepsake box? How do those stages happen? Well, that's the developmental process. With the brain as it's changing. And so the child will also go through different ages and stages of being able to process information. So cognitive development. A lot of studies have been done, right? On the child will go through a very concrete reasoning stage. And so very black and white matter of fact. And so those are some of the questions we get asked early on by children, the fact-based questions. But then eventually, they can become conceptual, and we see that in the education process. You start with the ABCs first. You start with 1 + 1 = 2, and then eventually algebra. You cannot teach a young child algebra because they can't conceptualize that. So most people understand that. Now the question is this. What would happen if a child falls into the hands of a predator, maybe even not trafficking, but in the home, in those various stages? And do we think that predators don't understand child development at these different stages? The one thing a predator wants is to violate a child. Then the other thing a predator wants is to never get busted. So depending upon the age and stage of the child, a predator, a perpetrator, is going to use different tactics. Now we think, well, certainly this child would remember. Well, really? Okay. Ask your own child about what happened or different things that happened in their life in the first year of their life, up to age 1. How much will your child recall? How about if you had a child and within the first year or so you moved? Would that child recall that first home even though they were there every single day? They won't. Right? Even up to like age 2 or 3 sometimes. So we understand that, but somehow we think, well, if something impactful happened, they would certainly remember that. Not necessarily, and even as adults. It's not uncommon for us to hear of a situation, let's say there's a car accident, and the driver, let's say there was no brain injury, the driver's head did not hit the windshield. Well, paramedics or first responders pull up the EMS, and let's say the driver says, no, let's say a little lady or whatnot. And the driver is saying, I'm fine, but the EMS, no, they want to take the adult to the emergency room, the hospital, just to be checked out. Well, let's say it turned out to be a little more trauma. Maybe there was a passenger that got injured. Maybe a passenger that actually died. So a traumatic event. The driver may or may not know about the death. Let's say they actually knew about the death. Well, let's say third day in the hospital, paramedics are delivering somebody else, but they want to stop in and see Mrs. Jones. And so they kind of poke their head in, they wave to Mrs. Jones, and Mrs. Jones may look at them like, who are you? Well, I don't think most EMS find that strange. They would probably reintroduce themselves to Miss Jones and say, oh, we brought you to the hospital. And she may say, I don't remember that. Let's say there's no actual brain damage. So her head did not hit the windshield. How do you describe that? And what do we call that, by the way? Right? We call that amnesia. But without any actual brain damage, how do you describe? We have a term, but I ask people this. Describe that for me. Where did the memory go? Well, most people have no problem saying, well, it was too difficult to remember, so it suppressed. Oh, so an adult with an adult-sized capability and capacity and cranium and cognitive development if automatically an adult has the ability to suppress, we don't think a child can do that.
Right.
So traumatic events can be suppressed. And there's very few things that are as traumatic as sexual abuse. So there can be an internal process happening within the core of the survivor that starts to split the personality. And unless we understand trauma, unless we're mindful of that, then we can actually do damage. We can add insult to injury to survivors and not be aware of it, and then end up causing them to move further away from the learn. So we need to be very mindful then how to deal with survivors.
Yes, memory suppression is not unique in the fact that we all have some traumatic experiences in our life where we care not to revisit it. And you may have gray area, but if you're a child who is being preyed upon, is most times the predator going to use some kind of psychology to threaten the child? Something bad's going to happen to you, your parents, your brother, your sister. I mean, I can see that they would, these animals would use some type of coercive threat to aid in that memory suppression. I mean, how many altar boys have come forward in the last 15 years that were victims of priests in the Catholic Church? You don't want to remember the vile things that occurred to you. If you're a Catholic, who is higher up on the pecking order than the priest?
That's right.
And you have your trust in them violated. Repression of memory and suppression of memory, I can completely understand where that would come into play. You know, my wife she cried through the whole movie, John. I almost didn't grab enough napkins for her. And being a teacher, an elementary school teacher, this really, really affected her. But she was not aware of the North American Man-Boy Love Association. We've had extreme conversations since this movie, and since watching this movie. And, you know, they've been around, since the 70s? They're trying to normalize pedophilia. They're trying to legalize pedophilia. They're trying to change language to reflect that they are minor attracted persons instead of the word pedophile, which has such a negative connotation, rightly so. But there are so many things, so much minutia behind the scenes that have kept people from pulling their head out of the sand and actually doing some research and understanding. And that aids and abets these predators more than anybody could even think. By not making yourself aware of what's going on and being in your little cocoon is not helping the issue. And I am so glad that they were finally able to release this movie and start this discussion. And, you know, child trafficking is evil, but so is what they're doing to these children. And it's churned my stomach. And John, we have already flown through 30 minutes, brother. We're going to have to take a brief pause. My guest today is John Euler. We're discussing minor attracted persons normalizing pedophilia. You're listening to Power of Prophecy. We're going to take a brief pause, and when we come back, we're going to dive right back in. Stay with us, won't you? We'll be right back. Hello, friends. Jerry Barrett back with you again. I want to offer a sincere thank you to everyone who supported the ministry. You know, I know the times financially are tough.
prices of groceries and gas and electricity, everything just keeps going up and up. And those of you who faithfully supported this ministry, you're the reason we're still here, and I want to thank you. We continue to ask for your help. You know, Tex didn't do this very often, and I don't like to do it very often myself, because so many of you are cheerful givers to the ministry, and we are so blessed that you do this. I want to thank you for your support for our Children's Home Project. It's through your love and support that we're able to do this each and every year, whether it's graduation or back to school or the Christmas project. It just means so much to these children and the house parents that it makes a big difference, and I want to thank you for that. Also, if you want to support the ministry long term, one thing that you can do is add Power of Prophecy into the will of your estate. You know, I don't like to ask for this much, but there were a number of people who were so led by the Lord that they added Power of Prophecy to their will and help the ministry continue to spread truth and the message and the love of Jesus Christ around the world on shortwave radio through our newsletters, our website. And you may consider that if you're interested in how to add Power of Prophecy to your will. You can contact the ministry by phoning us toll free in the United States and Canada at 1-800-234-9673. If you care to phone us on our regular line, that number is 512-263-9780. We're in the office Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Central Time. You can call the office, but as always, we appreciate your continued prayers for our ministry. So thank you from Sandra and myself. God bless you. Okay, and now let's return to our regular program. My guest today is John Euler. John, welcome back.
Jerry, thank you. It's great to be with you.
Now, there is a man, I refuse to call him a gentleman. There is a man that pretty much you could consider the father in as much of pedophilia. He is immortalized with a statue at Indiana University, and his name is Alfred Kinsey. He did research on sexual proclivities, but he was a pedophile, and I think he did as much damage as humanly possible to the family and mindsets of youth as far as sexual activity goes. You had mentioned the last time we visited that you became dear friends with Dr. Judith Reisman, who wrote the outstanding book, Kinsey Crimes and Consequences, and she exposed this evil man like nobody else, right?
That's right. That's right.
The things that he put into mainstream belief system has pretty much destroyed the family, the idea of chastity until you're married. It really is stomach churning to realize the amount of damage that this man did to our civilization.
That's right. If you want to destroy a culture, you can do one of two things, just like destroy the church. You do it from the outside. So with the church, we call that persecution. We call it an invasion from the outside if it's a nation. Or you do subterfuge, or you eat away at the foundation from within. So within the church, we call that false teaching and false prophets and whatnot. So it was a brilliant move, and what Judith uncovered was really that Kinsey was a brilliant move on the part of the CIA and the Rockefeller Foundation. The last paper that she worked on, the last major paper, it was during that time that she was working on it that I had the privilege of being introduced to her. And like you, I was first introduced to her through her work Kinsey Crimes and Consequences. I heard her on the radio when I was out in Sacramento describing it. And that changed the world for me because I was heading into the field of counseling at that time, or probably in ministry, but thinking, no, I think I made the change. So to realize that the entire body of, or the foundation of human sex and sexuality and what we know, for instance, to show you how ubiquitous now the influence, the diabolical influence of Kinsey was. If you ask people if they've ever heard the phrase, children are sexual from birth, that came from Kinsey. It's a lie. He did his work, which included among those that helped him do his research, were pedophiles. And if you ask someone this, if you found out that there was an adult that says a one-year-old can come to climax within 3 minutes, what would you think just happened to that child?
I know what happened.
Right? And let's say that person said, oh, well, that's nothing. I have a whole table, an Excel spreadsheet on kids from 6 months all the way up to their teen years or younger. And I can tell you how many kids, and I have a stopwatch, and I've cataloged all this. I call it a table. And so I've got 30 kids, and I can tell you it takes them to climax. What would you know about me? What did I just disclose? I'm a serial pedophile. Mm-hmm. That's Alfred Kinsey. And so the entire sexual revolution was established by an entomologist, a bug, you know, he's a biologist. Okay, but it was funded by the Rockefeller Foundation, selected by the CIA. And so Judith was working on her paper to expose that when she passed away after having a second COVID jam. But it was during that time that she and I have a special mutual acquaintance, Dr. Elizabeth Taylor out in Australia, a brilliant woman who has spoken a lot about queer theory. And so the three of us became fast friends, and Judith kind of had me on speed dial, and we were working on this paper. I mean, I was helping her, and it was neat that because she quickly found out about my work with perpetrators, and she was very intrigued by it because she had sort of begun kind of giving them the benefit of the doubt in this sense, that assuming that they had experienced trauma. And my work with perpetrators in the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections on psych staff while doing sex offender treatment, and I'm still a sex offender treatment provider now in the community, revealed, because Judith's work revealed, that the most sophisticated of perpetrators were not themselves the victims of perpetration. And so that sort of opened her eyes in another way. And so she asked if I would write a book with her. So we were starting that process at the point in which she died. So I'm very sad for that. But to think that the entire sexual revolution and pornography. So as Judith said, that Hugh Hefner, who started the pornographic industry, was inspired because of Kinsey. So Kinsey posited that the underneath the surface in the U.S., there's a whole lot of sexual loose morals, and that's all Hugh Hefner needed to hear. And it gave him license then to launch into his own lifestyle and start Playboy. So Kinsey can be directly, or Playboy, and therefore all the whole pornography issue can be traced to Kinsey. And then Kinsey was closely associated with Aleister Crowley, and Judith kind of traced this. Aleister Crowley, surnamed the Beast, who called himself the most wicked man in the world. You know, you got to be pretty bad to get kicked out of Italy. He was from England. He transitioned over to Italy and Abbey there. And Mussolini was so disgusted with Aleister Crowley that he kicked him out because likely there was human sacrifice going on. And in this home that he rented, called an abbey, there he had murals, satanic murals, all over this house. And Aleister Crowley and Kinsey, according to Judith, there was correspondence between Kinsey and somebody that was in a key position in the Third Reich doing experimentation on kids. a pedophile that was giving Kinsey information, and then Kinsey was interacting with Aleister Crowley. Judith is convinced that Kinsey flew to Italy to get hold of the diary or exchange of letters that were exchanged between Kinsey and Aleister Crowley. Judith even is pretty convinced that Kinsey was funding some of Aleister Crowley's lifestyle. And then the piece that has come since that time is the connection between a guy by the name of Kenneth Anger. How's that for a name? He recently died.
Right.
Kenneth Anger was a low-budget filmmaker, but very satanic. And Kenneth Anger had two people that enamored him, that he had discourse with and knew very closely. Kenneth Anger knew Aleister Crowley and Kinsey, and Kenneth Anger helped a low-budget individual, I think was a carnival worker at first, called Anton LaVey, get his break into film and then help launch a nonprofit called the Church of Satan. So it's important for people to see who Kinsey interacted with to understand how diabolical the CIA was in order to shift a culture off of its firm moorings. And therefore, now pornography is now ubiquitous. And the thing that drives child trafficking, the thing that drives all these pedophiles, is pornography. Deviance is the process downward. Pornography now fuels it. And for any researcher not to include pornography in looking at any of these aspects of what causes guys to do that, that's like us talking about arsonists and not talking about matches and gasoline. Yet a lot of these researchers that are pushing pedophilia, the legalization or decriminalization of it, such as James Cantor and others, there's a number of male sexologists out of Ontario, Canada. Although Michael Bailey is deviant as the day is long, he was out of Northwestern University. They all kind of hang out together, and they had influence in the DSM-5. And the DSM-5 made all the trans deception medical stuff billable. So without the DSM-5, you wouldn't have the trans movement, actually, without pornography and the DSM-5. If you want to make the trans movement go away, you get rid of pornography and the DSM-5. You go back to the diagnosis and the DSM-4, and the entire trans movement goes away. So you can still see how it's traced back to Kinsey, but people need to understand that pornography is the fuel of all this. And ever since pornography, you will not find, so my contention, ever since the 80s, probably the 70s, you will not find a sexual offense on the part of a guy that does not have pornography involved, meaning 100% of sex offenders. During my 11 plus years working on psych staff in the Department of Corrections, I did a deep dive into all sorts of backgrounds because I had access to all the files. And the one thing you will see 100% of the time is prior to a guy sexually offending, he's deeply involved in pornography. And 100% of all pedophiles, or what they're trying to call now, they're trying to reframe minor attracted persons, that's a lie. That is a distortion. That is to flip sympathies, is to deflect off of the victim and onto the perpetrator. 100% of men that have violated children, minors, are busted with child rape porn. And the vast majority, 98-99%, are also charged with the dissemination or the distribution. So they're passing that stuff along. So people need to understand that pornography, the mind of a man that has perpetrated upon a child, and for every child that's trafficked, how many deviant predators have watched the rape of that child through video or even in live content? So it's like a pyramid. For the few that are going to actually touch a child physically, how many more are watching it? And eventually those guys are going to go on. You cannot contain that. And that's why the idea of sex bots and sex dolls, James Cantor tries to say, well, it's a good alternative. No, it's not an alternative because it's pouring gasoline on a fire. Because anybody that would say that sex bots are, now they're talking about artificial intelligence. Well, you know what? Maybe if we just give pedophiles access to three-dimensional AI where they can just kind of watch that, maybe it will decrease the propensity or likelihood they're going to create another victim. This is being put forth now. And what I tell people is this, anybody that utters that has never worked with predators. What it will do, it will supercharge the process. Garbage in, garbage out. You cannot feed a mind on something, and every advertiser knows that. And so any supposed researcher that would suggest such a thing, I believe, needs to have their electronics, their computer, their online equipment and, you know, online access and what they've been looking at and their financial records and their phones, GPS. They need to have them all accessed by law enforcement. And now this stuff is creeping into churches. We've talked about because the predators, along with child trafficking, and Jerry, you talked about your wife's visceral response and your visceral response to seeing the sound of freedom, and it should engage us. But it's happening in churches as well, because predators look for plausible deniability, and the best place to do that, to have additional cover, are in churches. And so kids are being trafficked in churches, these perpetrators. So what people can look for, I might as well jump into that real fast, is, you know, if you're going to be somebody that's going to traffic kids, you're going to look for vulnerable kids. Where do you find those? Or, you know, kids that are easy prey. And plus, you're going to look for the greatest amount of kids in a single location. So schools, sporting events, Boy Scouts. We talked about prior to the break what's happened in as far as the numbers of kids that have been perpetrated upon. The Boy Scouts, I'm looking at an article from 2021, more than 84,000, this was from NBC News, I think. It says more than 84,000 people, men, boys, were perped on by Boy Scout leaders. Let that sink in. 84,000, and it goes on to say that the majority of the clients are in their 60s and 70s. They kept that a secret for that. Now, that's boys. There are far more women that have been perped on than men. And so churches are filled with people who are keeping a secret, and it's a stumbling block to them. When Jesus said, you better to put a millstone around your own neck, there's the warning, this brief therapy for someone who would even think about it. Okay, the word is scandalon. It's a large, well, we get the word scandalize. And what it's talking about is Jesus said, you're going to scandalize somebody, because the most effective way to mess somebody's view of God up, to hinder their relationship with God, is to sexually perpetrate upon them. Because deep down inside, the kid is wondering, if there is a loving God, then why? Okay, now you've saddled that, you've put that around that kid's neck. The most challenging thing for me in my work with survivors is to help answer the question, if there's a loving God, then why? And then, Jerry, you asked, what are the different tactics? Threats are often used, but what I didn't know until working with the perps, that actually comes later. The majority, because you have one of two ways to gain access to a kid if you're going to perp on them. You snatch and grab, or you do by force. Okay, that's the movie Sound of Freedom. Or you manipulate a child. And the very first aspect of manipulation of a child, because the perp ultimately doesn't want to get busted, is they will befriend the child. They will establish a special bond. Okay, so look what's going on with the trans deception. Look at the position that teachers can be in. Look at the position that mentors and coaches can be in, and Boy Scout leaders. So perpetrators will first and foremost come across as very endearing, very socially engaged, very kind and compassionate, and the least suspected. So that's why people in churches need to be mindful. If you have somebody that appears very outgoing, who people trust, and they will maneuver their way into positions of trust because now people are going to drop their guard. But if you have an adult that seems like a quote unquote kid magnet, that kids just gravitate to this adult, that's the first red flag. And what pastors, pastoral staff, what churches need to be a group of men that can come alongside that man and say, hey, we're happy to have you, you know, we're glad you like kids, but come over with us adult men. Okay, so if you have somebody that seems inordinately, uniquely interested in spending time with kids, because think about in marriage counseling, the two things that most wives will complain about is this. He doesn't talk to me anymore, and he won't spend time with the kids. Most men have to be reminded to spend time with the kids. So if you have a man that seems uniquely interested in spending time with kids, be very mindful. We're not going to blacklist him, because we do need youth directors, but never, ever alone. So that should be first and foremost. But then we have to have child abuse training, and that's not enough to just do a background check and fingerprints, because we assume that perpetrators wouldn't lie. Well, they would never sign an agreement, right? if they're going to perp, that'll stop them. What, the world's greatest liars who get off on manipulating people? You don't think they would lie? And the majority of perpetrators have never been busted. So you can run a background check on these guys. How about Larry Nassar? He had a clean background check, right? So these guys are perping on kids for years because they first have endeared themselves, then they leverage that. Once it's taken enough time, and once the kid starts to catch on, then it'll shift to, once the guy knows he's busted, or the possibility of being busted, then he's going to start to mention somehow to the kid that what we have, this is our special secret, and then eventually it's going to be, oh, you know what? If anybody found out, oftentimes they'll do this. I would get in trouble. You don't want that. If that still isn't enough in the perpetrator's mind, then maybe they're going to play the guilt trip. So the first, they endear themselves. Then once it's run its course, then he's going to start to cash in on that. So he's going to start to leverage, oh, we have a good thing or a special thing nobody would understand. So now we're going to start to ensure secrecy. If that's not going to be enough, they'll start to play upon bad things will happen to me if I'm the perp. Well, that plays on the kid's heartstrings. If that's not enough, that's where they will start to shift to threats. And at first they'll be, well, nobody will believe you anyways. And you know what? Let's just forget about this whole thing. But then if that's not going to be enough, that's where the threats come in to the kid or to the family. It's usually going to start to the family first. But it'll also be, oh, you know what? That'd be a horrible thing if people started to find out what you were doing. So they do psychological warfare on these kids, and eventually it'll be threats. And early on, they will also implement magical thinking for these kids. And this is where you can get what's called ritualistic abuse that is actually listed now as a kind of abuse. That simply means this. The perpetrator has had regular and consistent access to a victim. That's why they know the child. It's either somebody in the home or has regular access to that child in the home. And they're doing things that has a pattern, like from 3 o'clock to 4 o'clock, the child gets perped on. The further a guy gets into deviance and he's fueling himself with porn, he will then become much more dark, much more malevolent. Eventually you can get into sadistic stuff. And then for thrills, and because some of them may be into it, you get into satanic stuff. And meanwhile, what's happening to the child's psyche and mind, they're starting to say, this isn't happening to me, I'm out of here. So we call that dissociation. And eventually they can become compartmentalized, so much so that where the average person has, you know, we have self-talk going on all the time. Everybody does. We call it our thoughts. But if you have been traumatized, especially as a kid, especially for survivors, that normal process becomes compartmentalized, and they have what are called parts, and that's different than demonic possession. These are their normal personality that most of us can move fluidly through the different emotional states. If you've been traumatized as a kid, it's like taking a sausage, right, and all of a sudden dicing it into little slices. Or maybe a roll of saltwater taffy with the rainbow of colors. The reason I say that is, along with this slicing process, the segmentation of the personality, it also coincides with different emotional states. So if you've ever met someone that seems to, or the label would be borderline personality disorder, but all of a sudden seems to shift very quickly during the day, and it's like, whoa, almost like I had one husband say, I thought my wife just was always having her period. There was just these mood changes. Okay, that's very indicative of wounded parts that have become tucked away. that can also kind of become encapsulated and stuck in time. So you can have very young parts that were being perfed on, and then other parts will be there to protect them. And if anybody wants to learn more about this, I recommend, and it's really neat because they've done a great job, a couple of guys, Dick Schwartz and Frank Anderson, both connected with Harvard. As a matter of fact, Frank Anderson consulted on the movie, the animated movie Inside Out. Little Riley, the family has moved from Minnesota to San Francisco, and she's having a hard time with her emotions. And it's an excellent movie. Frank Anderson consulted on that movie, so it's based in good neurobiology, to understand the different parts. And that's with a kid that isn't even traumatized. And so that's a good primer. When I talk about grief and loss and I have a seminar, I actually use that film to help people understand that we can have different conflicting emotional states. That's even if we haven't been traumatized. But if you end up traumatizing a kid, that normal process of accessing different emotions and emotional states becomes segmented, and now there isn't the smooth transition. There are distinct personality states, but still all the same person. There are five different reasons for voices, one of which would be demonic possession. The other is crazy, that we call that schizophrenia. But then there's three, one of which is trauma. And so a trauma survivor, and think about the kids on that movie, don't tell me those kids wouldn't dissociate from that trauma. And so those parts that tend to kind of go away for safekeeping, the more profound the trauma, the more they will actually hear those parts of themselves. So the last thing we want to do, if an adult later on, since it's usually not right away that they'll ever disclose, they suppress these emotions, let's say they come to church, and they start re-experiencing. If you're an effective preacher, you're going to begin to help the healing process, and those wounded parts will start to come out. And if we can't handle somebody that's evidencing maybe some unusual behaviors, and it takes discernment, but pastors need to know, because I was not taught this going through Talbot, that not all abnormal behaviors are demonic. You can have people that were deeply wounded, that parts of them have very legitimate questions, exactly the questions that Job wrestled through. And we need to be able to extend compassion to those same individuals to help them understand that God understands the anger. Because when you watch that film, the big question is, if there's a loving God, then how does he allow this? And we know the theological answers, but to a child, those children that are rescued from that, or the children now adults that have gone through incest and different things in the home, they have legitimate questions. God can handle those, but they need people, need us, to be able to be the Lord's hands and feet and compassion and allow them to go through the healing process without kind of dumping on them intellectual guilt-tripping stuff. They just need time to heal, and that's how, practically speaking, we can help kids that have been trafficked or kids now, once they disclose later on as adults, to heal, that we give them space, we give them time as they're working through these very difficult, deep wounds.
Mm. John, I want to thank you so much for coming on the program and discussing this with me and the listeners. I greatly appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule.
Jerry, I appreciate you talking about this subject and having me.
All righty. Well, I told you before, I'll give you another holler. So I always appreciate your time and your expertise, and I wish you the best, and I pray you have a blessed day.
Jerry, I appreciate it.
Okay, that was my guest, John Euler. I want to thank you for tuning in and giving us an hour of your time. As always, I greatly appreciate it. And I pray you will tune in again next week at this same time. Tune in and discover the power of prophecy.